compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello and good morning and muchas enchiladas. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. Here's the number, 888-914-9149. If you call that number, especially if you call right now, we can easily get you on the air. But as I'm looking at the call board, the lines are filling up, so don't wait too long. 888-914-9149. Go to patrick@relevantradio.com. I have a note that came in from Brandon in Mesa, Arizona. At the Transfiguration was time, I think he means were, time and eternity mixed, and a window into the universe of the divine opened for man to see. I understand the symbolic angle of the law and the prophets. I'm asking about the reality of these events. What happened? Fair enough, Brandon. So we know in the Transfiguration of the Gospels that Jesus climbed up, hiked up a very tall mountain, we're told. And if it is Mount Tabor, most of the consensus is that it's Mount Tabor. There are other high hills, small mountains in the area that could fit that bill. But it seems that the majority view is that Mount Tabor in Galilee is the hill, the mountain that the Lord climbed with his three closest apostles, Peter, James, and John. So I've been up there any number of times when on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And it's apparently at the top of that mountain where the Lord, as we read in the Gospels, became transfigured in that he was blindingly brilliant light emanating from him. His garments were exceedingly white. I mean, in our modern movies, we depict things like that, and I can kind of get a mental image of what that must have looked like. But whatever it was so overpoweringly bright and vivid that it basically incapacitated Peter, James, and John. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to say. Peter said, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. Should we build some booths?" And this is referring to tents from the Jewish feast day, the Feast of Booths. And he didn't really know what to say, so he said that. But in the middle of all this, they also saw Moses and Elijah conversing with the Lord. Now, it doesn't say, this is interesting, it doesn't say anything about the appearance of Moses and Elijah. I'm sure it was otherworldly and ethereal, but the resplendent, the refulgence of the Lord's glory is only something that is used to describe him. So I'm guessing from the text at least that by comparison, even with Moses and Elijah, the Lord's glory was overpowering. So was that time and eternity mixing together? I don't think so. I think what that was, I mean, depends on how you mean the question. When you say, is it a mix of time and eternity, it would depend on what you mean by that. So if by that, do you mean that time and eternity were superimposed in a certain sense? I don't think so for this reason, that the Lord's change in appearance, the transfiguration, did not require that eternity be present, whatever that might mean. And rather, he could be seen by his apostles in a glory that would be short of the beatific vision, because by all accounts, nobody can see God except for those who are pure of heart. As Jesus himself said in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, "Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God." And Revelation 21:27 says, "Nothing unclean can enter heaven." So the view of the church is that in order to see God as he really is, you have to be fully prepared. You have to be fully purified and clean of heart in every respect. And I don't think St. Peter, St. James, and St. John were at that point yet. I'm pretty confident that they were not at that point. So whatever it was they saw didn't need to be in eternity, because it was still a natural phenomenon, a supernatural phenomenon to be sure, but something that could be beheld in this natural world. So my sense of it is that this mysterious event was a way in which the Lord could let his apostles catch a glimpse of not even the full amount of his true glory, his true divinity, but just a glimpse of it, still at a natural level that with their eyes and their human minds that they could comprehend, not being prepared to enter into heaven at that point. So that's what I think happened. I don't think it was like a window opened into eternity or anything like that. I think it was this partial heavenly glory that was revealed even just briefly and in a very muted way to the apostles. That's what I think happened. Now, obviously, we can all have our own opinion, and the story of the transfiguration in the Gospels doesn't come alongside a description of what exactly happened, so we're free to surmise how we might explain that. But based on the question that you asked, Brandon, that's my explanation for it, and I appreciate that. 888-914-9149. Well, we've got almost a whole board of people ready to get on the air, so let's start with that. Why don't we go to Bill in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Good morning, Bill, and welcome.
Patrick, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A lifelong Catholic, never been married, 75 years old, battled with low-grade depression for many years coming out of it.
Okay.
My I've been a daily communicant for probably 20 years.
That's great.
I've had my faith revived in a way lately. I have more confidence and so forth. 8 years ago, I permitted my prostate to be removed because of a cancerous tumor.
Okay.
Am I eligible to be married in the Catholic Church?
You would need to have a medical, well, I can tell you that one of the impediments for a valid marriage is perfect impotence. Now,
or sterility. Yeah.
No, not sterility. Sterility is not an impediment to marriage, but perfect impotence is for the man. And by that, it just means, you know, ain't no way, if that makes sense. And that would be an impediment, and I don't know, a canon lawyer could tell you whether or not that's an impediment that can be overcome in terms of a dispensation. It's possible that there could be a dispensation granted. Sterility is not an impediment, but perfect impotence is. So that may or may not apply to you. And if it doesn't apply to you, then that in itself would not pose an impediment. And, and whatever else may be involved there. That would be a medical question. But if you wanted to pursue marriage, when you are in conversation with the parish priest, sort of going through the marriage prep and all that, bring that up. And of course, the woman in question should know about it as well. If it's
that's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. That before I even get started, you know, as soon as it starts to get a bit serious, I really need to talk to her about this.
Yes, I mean, it may not be a. And here again, I don't know what the medical circumstances are, and I don't want to ask you about that because that's your private information. But in the church's list of different things that would be an impediment, that's listed as one of them. So your parish priest can put you in touch with the canon lawyer on the tribunal if you want, and in your diocese, and you could find that. But yes, I mean, I would bring that up with her. But if you're 75, and is she similar age to you, or is she much younger?
I don't have a candidate. I have one lady I've been friendly with for many years.
I see.
I've never gone out with anybody else. She's she's a baptized Catholic who is profoundly anti-Catholic. I'm the type of person who's very loyal. She's been a very loyal friend, but she bristles anytime religion comes up.
She may be a wonderful person, but I would look askance at that. I mean, how would you... How would you have a happy marriage if you can't agree on God?
Exactly. I was discussing marriage in general, and she made some comment that indicated, you know, like, why am I not a candidate? And I didn't discuss it with her, but I mean, for years, I had a close friend I talked to. I said, that's a deal breaker.
Her being anti-Catholic, you mean?
Her being anti-Catholic,
yeah.
I can't,
Well, when the time comes, Bill, I would say if and when you find the right woman, yes, this is something to share with her. But at the same time, checking in with the priest about this, because it may be that it's something that could be dispensed with the bishop. So that's the next step to find out. I don't have in front of me here in studio the the exact terminology, but I think I might be able to get that book. It may be somewhere here in the studio, and I can quote the relevant section of it maybe later in the show today.
Okay. Patrick, okay. Thank you very much. By the way, you mentioned Mount Tabor. I was told that it is a geologically distinct mass that was thrown up during the movement of tectonic plates probably eons ago. But it's different from the surrounding area.
That may well be.
That's Mount Tabor that's venerated as the location.
It's a conical mount. It's not really a mountain. I mean, I'm from Southern California. And
yeah, I know.
They have mountains there. This is not like that. But it's a very, very, like very that. Large hill. And it's got a distinctive shape. It's sort of conical. Very steep. I can't imagine. I mean, walking up it with a paved road, it's a switchback road. And that's I've never even walked it. I've always been in a vehicle. But that would take the better part of a day, I would think, to get all the way up there from the valley floor. Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. And I hope things turn out well for you in that regard. How about Sylvia now in the Bronx? Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi there.
First, I'd like to say thank you for the work you, Cyrus, and the entire Relevant Radio team does for us.
Thank you so much.
I just recently lost my mom on Resurrection Sunday.
I'm very sorry.
Thank you. She was our light. She was just present for everyone. So I just wanted to find out from you if there is any significance to passing away on Easter and Resurrection Day.
Yeah, I think there would be, sure. And if nothing else, I mean, in God's providence, we don't always know why certain things happen on certain days, like feast days of the church, for example. But what a beautiful thing, and I would think it's comforting to you and your family to know that your mom died on the day that Jesus rose from the dead, and that her baptism and her being a follower of Jesus means that she shares in that resurrection as well. Jesus died for her so that she can rise into eternal life. Isn't that comforting?
It sure is, and that has kind of been the one consoling factor, because she was such a beautiful person.
Yeah.
She was a beautiful person.
Yeah. What is her name that we can pray for her by name?
Augustina.
Augustina. We will definitely pray for her, the repose of her soul, and for consolation and comfort to you and your family. I'm sure all of you are feeling pretty terrible right now.
Yes, we sure are. Thank you so much.
You're
Thank
welcome,
you, Patrick.
Sylvia. You're
Keep
welcome,
up the
Sylvia.
Great work.
Thank you. May she rest in peace, Augustina, and may your family receive lots and lots of comfort from the Lord. What a terrible, difficult thing to go through. Let's see, 888-914-9149. How about Vinny in New Jersey? That sounds like an appropriate name. Good morning, Vinny.
Good morning, Vinny. Patrick.
I couldn't help myself. Sorry about that. I've seen too many movies. Good morning, Vinny.
I don't mind. It's a compliment. I just wanted to add, my son went to Mass. He works in New York, and he went to Mass at 5 o'clock on Holy Saturday. He said it was like a regular Mass. They had a choir, and it was like an hour long. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I thought there weren't supposed to be any Masses till the Holy Saturday Mass at 8 o'clock when everything has to be dark, because that's the biggest time of the year. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to know, is it okay that he went to this Mass? Does it count for Easter?
Well, did he go to a Catholic church?
Yeah, I think it's called St. Malachi. Mm-hmm. They call it the Actors' Chapel.
That's in New York City? Okay.
Yeah.
How did he describe it? What did he say was going on there?
All he told me was that it was like a regular Mass, and they had a choir and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's weird.
I know that the church does not have Mass on Good Friday. So that much, I mean, if he went to Mass, quote-unquote Mass, on Good Friday, and it was an actual Mass, that would be out of the ordinary, to say the least, because the church says that they're not to be Masses celebrated on Holy Friday or Good Friday. On Holy Saturday, though, I don't know that that's the case. And it may be, as you know, one of those little factoids that I probably should know. But off the top of my head, I don't know if it is prohibited or not. But let me just take a look here. So we have the Holy Thursday Mass, of course, no Mass on Good Friday. And so the only Mass on Holy Saturday would be the Easter Vigil Mass.
So
that I just verified it looking at the Bishop's Conference website. So there is no Mass per se during the daytime of Holy Saturday. The Easter Vigil Mass, and it doesn't sound like that coincides with the time when your son went. But what time of day was the Mass that he attended?
5 PM.
Okay, well, that would count as the vigil. That would count as the vigil Mass. Because the vigil Mass, the vigil begins at 4 p.m. for any, you know, Sunday or feast day. So the church counts 4 p.m. or later the evening before as the vigil. So if it were at 5 o'clock, that would count as a vigil Mass.
Okay. All right. So he's in the clear?
He didn't do anything wrong. No. No, it's good that he went to Mass. So I'm assuming he went to that Mass in lieu of going on Sunday.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Good Friday, just to show what the Bishop's Conference says here, Good Friday and Holy Saturday, no Masses. So if you went to the Veneration of the Cross service on Good Friday, then you most likely would have received communion when everything was said and done, but it would not have been a Mass. There would have been readings and some prayers and whatnot, but there would not have been a Mass, and the same is true for Holy Saturday. The Vigil Mass, though, beginning any time from 4 p.m. after is licit and prescribed by the church.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Glad I could help. Thank you. And also gave me an opportunity to double check to make sure that I understood what the church's rule is on that. Thanks, Vinny. We'll take a break and we'll come back to more of your phone calls. We had a line open up just now. You can call in and grab it, 888-914-9149. That number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. And yes, today is Taco Tuesday. So good vibes here on the Patrick Madrid Show. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at notredamefcu.com/join. That's notredamefcu.com/join.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Oh, give me the beef, boys, and my tacos. I want some hot sauce and my burrito.
All right. Let me hear this.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Give me the beef, boys, and my tacos. I want some hot sauce in my burritos and stuff my face.
I wonder what St. Thomas Aquinas would think of that.
He'd love it.
He classified it in the category of gluttony, maybe. I don't know. Or maybe the beatific vision, somewhere in there.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah. 888-914-9149. A couple quick things before we go back to the phones. First of all, I have a note here from James, and he says, can you give me the name of that drug and alcohol recovery program that you have often mentioned on your show? You said the program has a high success rate. This would be for someone who is at the point of living on the street and is abusing aerosol spray cans. Wow. I'm not directly involved in the situation, but I was asked by someone who is, and I'd like to know the info. So, Jim, the info is it's an organization called the Comunità Cenacolo. That's Italian. In English, we'd say the Cenacle Community. And their website is hopereborn.org. Young Thomas, write this down, please, because I know we'll be deluged with people calling in. What was that address that Patrick gave? It's hopereborn.org. Hopereborn.org. And it is a Catholic community founded by a religious sister. They have centers in different parts of the world. They happen to have a center in, I think it's in the St. Augustine, Florida area. And in my previous mentions of this organization, this Catholic group, a few things that I've mentioned before. One is that I knew, it's been years now, but I knew two different, separate, unrelated, unknown to each other Catholic families, each of whom, in one case a son, in the other case a daughter, who were severely addicted to drugs and, I don't know, maybe alcohol too, I don't know. And the kids went there as, I don't know if they were teenagers or young adults. And they went, and I think you go for at least 2 or 3 years. It's not like you go there for a weekend or a month or something. It's a more of a commitment. And they both experienced freedom and liberation from what they had been enslaved by. And there are many other stories of victory and things like that. So it's not for everybody, but it is for some people. And the other thing that is really strikes me as amazing about this is that they don't charge you anything for it. If you want to donate, you can, but they don't say, all right, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, it will cost you $10,000 a month for your daughter to come here for 3 months or so. It's not like that. So they have community, work, prayer, fun. It's all very wholesome. It's all very Catholic and so on. And it seems to really work. So yes, I would definitely check into them. HopeReborn.org. 888-914-9149. Now, interestingly, I mentioned yesterday that there was this decree from El Presidente about making Easter Sunday the day of trans visibility. And naturally, people who didn't read very carefully, they didn't read his decree very carefully, they immediately started up with, well, that was planned long ago, and that has nothing to do with Easter Sunday, and that's not really the deal. It just so happened to fall on Easter Sunday, blah, 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 blah. He specifically designated in the presidential order, specifically the date of Easter Sunday this past weekend. Okay, so yes, it's common knowledge that these things are set up on a calendar a long time in advance, but people understand when Easter Sunday is. So all of those sort of pointless rejoinders notwithstanding. The odd thing about this is that yesterday, the president was asked about this and he denied knowing anything about it. So this is what's interesting. So he was asked about proclaiming Easter as the trans day of visibility. He says, I didn't do that. So he was talking with reporters, I guess. He was asked the question and Real Clear Politics reported that he just said, I didn't do that.
Did I do that?
Well, now, let's be respectful here. So when asked about Speaker Johnson's claim that he had done it, President Biden said he's thoroughly uninformed. So this sort of took on a life of its own, and people are now saying, well, did his, you know, office do it? Are the people responsible for his public-facing comments on social media? Did they do it? Did he really know or did he not know? Is he shirking a controversy or did he really not know? And that's, you know, it's unknown at this point. But
what are we talking about?
The latest is that the president denied having anything to do with it. So that being the case, I did get a note from somebody who
said, even though it came from his Twitter account and from the White House.
That's the oddity.
Okay.
Is
all right,
that,
just check him.
Do you really honestly imagine that these high level figures, you know, maybe a few of them, maybe, you know, some of the younger and more technologically savvy members of Congress or in some other government position, perhaps, but the ones who are much older, I just can't picture President Biden sitting around typing a tweet. I just can't picture that. So it may well be that it had nothing to do with him per se, but his coterie of helpers. But we don't know. And he says he didn't do it. So if we take him at his word, that means somebody else did it. And then the question becomes is it that person, does that person have the authority of the president to declare that that day will be, instead of the celebration of the resurrection of Jesus, that it's a trans awareness day? No.
Well, if they don't have that authority, there's a job opening at the White House.
Oh, I feel your cynicism today, loud and clear. But so I just wanted to bring that up to date. And anyway, I had an email of somebody who wrote in and said, "Yeah, you should just ignore it. Come on, yet again, it was one of these sort of missing the point emails. It had nothing to do with Easter Sunday. It was just, you know, on the calendar. It happened to be that day." Well, yes, of course, these things are posted long in advance, but it was clearly intended to take place on Easter Sunday. And not every Easter Sunday going forward, but just the Easter Sunday that we just had. Anyway, and so that person who wrote to me said, just ignore it. No, sir. No, that's the problem. That's how we got to where we are today. People ignoring it and ignoring it and ignoring it and saying nothing and not speaking up, not speaking out, not being, you know, reactive to things like this. And I would say that's the worst possible advice would be to ignore things like this, because that's how we got down this far down the road where we are now. So there's that. Just want to bring that to your attention. 888-914-9149. How about Rich now in Oviedo, Florida? Hi, Rich.
Hey, Patrick. Question for you, a little moral question.
Sure.
I have a nephew who I'm close with is moving down. But unfortunately, he's moving in with his girlfriend, and I got a couple of teenage girls. Is it right for me to visit him, per se? I mean, he can come over to my house and such, but I'm just wondering what you think of that.
So if your nephew's in his apartment and he and his girlfriend live together as if they were married, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, so it takes on a different appearance, I guess, if you go there to visit them as if they were a married couple in their home. So I understand why you'd be squeamish about that, because one of the realities is that it could give the impression that you're okay with it. It would be kind of normalizing a serious sin. It would be giving the impression that, you know, no big deal, I'll come over and break bread with you. So the better thing to do would be, if you ask me, would be, hey, if you want to have a meal or something, let's go to a restaurant or let's get a picnic or something like that. But for that reason, I would refrain from doing that so that I didn't give either of them the misimpression that I thought what they were doing was okay.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now I'm going to tell you what somebody who would take the devil's advocate position would say. They'd say, but Patrick, Jesus went to the home of sinners. Jesus ate with Pharisees and tax collectors, and there were prostitutes hanging around. Jesus did exactly what you're saying not to do. Yeah, but he was Jesus and he's the Messiah and the Redeemer. I'm not. And the Lord, of course, was on a mission to save these people. He came to save everybody, not just, you know, the people who had it more or less all together. So that's a different kind of thing. And by Jesus going there, you notice he wasn't thereby approving of or giving the impression that he approved of whatever sinful activity these people were involved in. He was going to find them, like the good shepherd going out in search of the lost sheep and so on. So there's a distinction there that for you or for me as, let's say, mom and dad or as an uncle or something like that, for you to go and say nothing and pretend as though it's okay is different from what Jesus was doing when he went to dine with tax collectors and the other assorted people. And the reason I mention is because I know that somebody is thinking that. They're going to call and say, but Patrick, Jesus went to go eat at the home of tax collectors. So I want to head that off at the pass to say it's not a valid comparison with what you're saying.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I hope that this has a happy ending. My suggestion would be you have a mission field in your backyard right here with your nephew and his girlfriend. So rather than freeze them out, the more you can evangelize them to the extent that they're willing to let you, the better it is. Because if you keep a friendly, happy relationship with your nephew, and you can, you know, if you haven't already gained his trust, so he will listen to you, and you can counsel him and advise him and say, you know, this is contrary to what it means to follow Jesus. You believe in Jesus, right? You know, questions like that. And maybe little by little, you can help him extricate himself from this situation and get back on track.
Yeah, that's definitely the plan. Absolutely.
Awesome.
That's great advice.
Well, I'm sure you're the man for the job, Rich.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah,
have a great.
Thank you. Yeah, you too. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Denise in St. John, Indiana. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, Patrick, and happy Easter to you and Cyrus
thank
and your
you.
Families.
Thank you.
You know, this is the weirdest thing. We just heard, one of my friends pointed out to me that a police officer in New York had a funeral mass on Saturday morning, Holy Saturday. And my own grandfather passed on Holy Thursday. And in those days, you know, you had the two-night wake. They couldn't do anything until Easter Monday. And I just thought, is that a rule in the church or is it okay? I just don't understand.
Well, it's funny you mention because there was a call earlier in this hour on the question of Mass on Holy Saturday. So
right.
What that stipulates is that there is no Mass, like a regular Mass that's celebrated for the parish, on Good Friday or Holy Saturday. But come 4 p.m. in the afternoon, that then goes into the territory of being the vigil Mass for Easter Sunday. So I don't know what the church's rules are with regard to a funeral Mass, which would be different from a regular, you know, parish Mass on a Saturday. My assumption is that it too would be not celebrated on Holy Saturday outside of some pressing need. If there was some really pressing, urgent need to do it, the church could dispense that. And maybe there was a dispensation. But most funerals don't have to be celebrated on a particular day. There's usually some time that could be delayed. So I don't really know what to tell you other than that maybe there was permission granted to celebrate that funeral Mass on Holy Saturday. I just don't know.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And like I said, I'm not criticizing. I just, you know, in fact, one of my good friends just lost her nephew a year ago and he died and they had to hold him over too. So this isn't something new, you know, but we just, yeah. Those are the only two examples we have. Well, thank you again, Patrick. Have a wonderful day.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome, Denise. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Emily now in Sacramento. Good morning, Emily.
Hi. My question is, if you know somebody that believes in God but doesn't want to worship Him, are you able to still save a person like that? And then, are they like going to worship God or believe more in God if they are saved, or do they not really have to do that just to be saved? Or I'm not really sure if you're able to see or what.
Okay, I'm not sure if I understood the question. Let me say it back to you and tell me if I have it right. Can somebody who doesn't really believe in God, or somebody who believes in God but doesn't really acknowledge Him or worship Him, is just like, yeah, okay, I believe He exists, but that's about it. Can that person be saved? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, looking basically at what Jesus says, I don't think so. In fact, I would say very likely no. Unless God has a breakthrough with that person before his death. So here are some Bible passages that talk about this. In John 8, verse 24, Jesus says, "That is why I told you, you will die in your sins, for if you do not believe that I am," meaning God, "you will die in your sins." That's one thing. We also read Jesus saying in John 3, beginning in verse 17, "For God sent the Son into the world, not to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not condemned. He who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God." Now, this friend of yours, or whoever this gentleman is, he might say, well, yeah, I believe in Jesus. And Jesus says, well, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but you do not do what I command you, which is par excellence, follow me, believe in me, follow me. Jesus says, it's not the one who says, Lord, Lord, who will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. And doing the will of the Father is to listen to Jesus. What do we hear the Father say? This is my beloved Son, listen to him. So if he says, yeah, I guess I believe in Jesus, but that's about it. I don't think that person can be saved, because it's maybe an acknowledgement, but it's not true faith. It's not saving faith. Hebrews 11:6 says, "Without faith, it's impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And it doesn't sound like the man that you're talking about is seeking God, does it?
Yeah, and it's more or less just a whole situation instead of one person. It's more multiple people, I feel like. And I just wasn't sure if like they would like kind of make them start to worship or believe more, or if it's just really, truly going to be decision.
Well, ultimately, of course, God is the one who does it, but he does work through instruments. So as Jesus gives us the story of the sower of the seed, I'm sure you know that from the Gospels, where he's scattering seed on different kinds of ground. Some ground is rocky. Some ground is very shallow. Some ground is heavily trampled, or the birds come and eat the seeds. And some ground is deep and rich, and the seeds can take root. And the sower of the seed doesn't really know exactly what kind of ground the seed is being scattered on. His job is to go out there and broadcast it wherever he can. So for you, my advice, if these are family members, for example, or a group of friends or some other group, just keep doing the best you can. Tell them to listen to Relevant Radio. Share with them the things that you know as a Catholic. Encourage them to go to Mass with you. There are a lot of different things you can do. And see what happens, and ask God to provide the increase. You scatter the seed, and you ask him to provide the increase. And some really amazing things can happen. People that you might think are the last people on earth who would ever, become devout. I don't know what that echoes from, but sometimes the last people on earth could be the very ones who become great saints. It has happened, and it can still happen. Well, I hope that's helpful, and we're going to take a quick time out, and we will be back with more of your phone calls and your emails on The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Today, we'd like to thank Rosario, who is listening in New Mexico, for donating her 2014 Fiat 500. Classy. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car.
I'm Lucky Dave.
I'm Ned Niederlander.
I'm Dusty Bottoms. And together, we're
the Three Amigos.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Taco
Town! That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Taco Town!
Well, the plot thickens. I had a call, I guess, asking about a mass on Easter Unholy Saturday. And so I was talking about the vigil mass rule, 4 p.m. or later. And to be sure, somebody quickly pointed out, nope, the USCCB says it's a nocturnal vigil. Has to happen after dark. So, hey, appreciate the fact checking. Thank you for that. And duly noted. Let's go now to Sophia in Hacienda Heights, California. Good morning, Sophia.
Good morning, Patrick. Awesome to be here on the show.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
So I just had a couple of questions. I wanted to see if you can give me some reference to the Bible and also just your opinion in general. But the first one was going to be about music, more okay. specifically rap, how it affects like our souls and our spirits. Just because I know it, a lot of the rap goes against, you know, what Jesus teaches us. And I just wanted to know, like, what if there's any background in the Bible about that, or just any advice or opinion that you can give me.
I'll give you what I can. It is a good question, Sophia. And before I get into some of the more theological issues, isn't it true that certain kind of music makes you want to just get up and dance? You know, just
yes.
the beat, or you know what I mean? Like maybe if you're like at a wedding reception, if you ever notice that certain songs that are super popular, it just makes you want to dance, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's part of our human physiology that, of course, being body and soul united as one unit, you might say, our minds, our souls, our wills, our intellect are affected by our bodies. And our bodies, of course, are affected by the mind, but maybe less so. We have to work hard to control our bodies. Otherwise, our bodies can control us. And when music is in question here, this is where we can see this. Like certain songs, you just feel like you've got to get up and dance. So if you put on, let's say you had a room full of little kids, if you were a preschool teacher or something like that. If you put on MC Hammer's song, You Can't Touch This, I guarantee you, I've seen this happen a million times, every single one of those little kids is going to start dancing because they're uninhibited and they don't care what people think. And, you know, they just start doing what they feel when the music comes on. And that would be an example of where we sort of instinctively are influenced by music, certain kinds of music. If you put on Mozart's, sonata in G major or something like that, the kids are not going to get up and dance. They're probably going to leave the room and try to look for something else to do because that music doesn't move them the way an MC Hammer, You Can't Touch This song, might move them. So with that as sort of the physiological foundation, what I would say is that there is a moral component to music, and I would propose two ways of looking at that. One would be strictly, what is the message of the lyrics? If the song has lyrics, what is its message? Is it promoting violence, rebellion, fornication, theft, all of the above, as some songs do? And so even just at that level alone, the lyrics are contrary to the gospel. The lyrics are glorifying or encouraging people to, at the very least, think about and maybe even do things that are contrary to the moral law. Would you and I agree on that point?
Yes, I definitely would agree with that.
Okay. So we could evaluate music or songs that have lyrics at that level and just say, nope, I'm not going to listen to that because of what it's saying. And although I haven't talked about this in a long time, I can think of one particular song. It's not the only one, but there's one particular song that I used to really like, and I had it in my digital music. And this is going back maybe 20 years ago or so. And I just really liked this song. And then one day it dawned on me, why am I listening to this song? Because it's promoting adultery. And the whole point of the song is that. That's the whole point of it. It's basically that. And so I had to have a moment of truth moment where I said, you know, I really enjoy the song, but I'm not going to listen to it anymore. And I deleted it. And every time I've ever mentioned it on the air, which is not very often, but when I've mentioned it, people say, well, what's the song? And I'm not going to say what the song is because I don't want other people to go listen to it. So that's another way you can evaluate music is, you know, does this music promote something in you that might be compromising your resistance to something that you know that you shouldn't do? Then the third thing would be the way in which music, certain kinds of music at least, if this is kind of going back to the first part I was talking about, is how does the beat, so the, say the syncopation of the beat, how does it affect your mood and your inhibitions? Now, as human beings, we all have certain inhibitions, and those are good. That's like a fence around a yard so that the wild animals can't get in, or that your kids won't walk out into the street. Or it's like lane stripes on a freeway. Imagine, Sophia, what it would be like if you got on the 10 freeway and there were no lane stripes. And you had all these cars and trucks trying to go down the 10 freeway, and there were no rules, like you just drive wherever you want. It would be a very dangerous place to be. I think we could all agree on that. So in the same way, some music, certain beats and syncopations, which is a kind of, I don't want to explain it too deeply here, but it can cause your inhibitions to come down, where people can become more prone to, say, sexual sin, as an example, or prone to violence that's being promoted through a kind of syncopated rhythm and beat. And this has been scientifically studied. So I'll conclude my explanation with this. There is a book, it's called Music and Morals, A Theological Appraisal of the Moral and Psychological Effects of Music. You don't have to know that subtitle, but Music and Morals by Father Basil Cole, C-O-L-E. He was a Dominican priest. And so he looks at the phenomenon of how music affects the mind and the body and your inhibitions and things like that. And he would show you, for example, how classical music, so-called, generally tends to elevate one's mind and one's mood, and it kind of it inculcates in you a kind of sense of elevation toward higher things, higher goods. And hip-hop or rap, that kind of thing, it has a tendency to degrade or push more downward to things that are not elevated and refined and beautiful, but more base and more crass, that kind of thing, or even worse than that. So if you want a book that will take you through all of these different things, insight studies and whatnot, perhaps that's the book you're looking for.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. And then just on the music note, I just wanted to ask this question just to know, but mm-hmm. I've heard people say that like Satan was the master of music, and I just wanted to know if that was true.
I've heard that too. I believe that's something from the Psalms, and I'd have to go back and double check that. I have heard people say that, but it would be wrong to extrapolate from that, as some people do, that therefore music is bad or instrumental music is bad. It would be similar to people who make the argument that it's bad to have a Christmas tree in your living room during the celebration of the Christmas season to celebrate the birth of baby Jesus, because a wicked, evil king in the Old Testament had Christmas, not a Christmas tree per se, but a decorated tree. So it's correlating two things that have nothing to do with each other. So even if there's something to it biblically about Lucifer or Satan in some way involving music, that in itself would not be any taint about using music or enjoying music. And for that matter, I'd have to really look more closely at that. I've heard a couple of people say this, so it bears some investigation. But let's not forget that the angels in heaven were given a test by God as soon as they were created. And the good ones passed the test, the bad ones failed the test and were immediately cast out of heaven. So it wasn't as though the angels were up there in heaven playing music and jamming and having a great old time, musically speaking. They don't have bodies. They don't play instruments or anything like that. So if there were a passage in Scripture that might refer to the devil in that sort of figurative way, he wasn't up there in heaven. He wasn't even in heaven, first of all. He wasn't in the beatific vision. None of the angels were until they took their test. And then after that, he was cast down. So that's a topic I think I'll do a little bit of research on. And when I have a few thoughts on that, I will share that on the air. How about that?
Sounds good, Patrick. And lastly, I just wanted to ask about tattoos.
Okay.
I've heard that from other people before I was stronger in my faith that like Catholics are really against that. But then I did a little bit of research and I saw that Catholic faith itself isn't necessarily opposed to it. But
yeah. So is there more to your question or is that your question?
Oh, that was it.
Okay. So we did almost a whole show on that very topic yesterday, Sophia. So it might be easier for you, if you have the time, to just listen through most of the whole show, certainly the first and second hour. And it's a topic that a lot of people wanted to know about, so we discussed that at great length. And I do share some things, including an article that you can get. Cyrus posted it on the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show. And it's called Tattoo You, or Physical Graffiti. And it was written by a deacon who analyzes the phenomenon of body art and body modification, including not just tattoos, but also piercings, etc. So my perspective, I'll just give you that, is I am definitely not a fan of tattoos. I have discouraged my adult children when they were younger from getting tattoos, not always successfully, by the way. I think they're a mistake and something that most people will likely regret later on. But the church does not say you can't get a tattoo. So that's maybe to your question, does the Catholic Church say you cannot get a tattoo? The answer is no. I just don't think it's a wise idea to do that. And I think the downsides are much more than the upside of having a tattoo. But rather than try to re-explain the whole thing all over again, if you check out yesterday's show, that will help you. And if you have any follow-up questions, give me a call back another time. But I'm getting close to a break, so I'll leave it at that. And you can get to yesterday's show by downloading the Relevant Radio app on your phone. And then you can go to shows and then go to yesterday's show and you can listen there or go to relevantradio.com. I'm sorry, relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on yesterday's show and listen to it that way. So I hope that's helpful to you. And we've just about reached a point, Sophia, where I have to take a break anyway. So I'll say goodbye. And do check out that book, Young Thomas. Jot this title down, please, if you didn't already. Music and Morals by Father Basil Cole. No doubt we'll have people saying, what was the name of that book on music? Music and Morals by Father Basil Cole, C-O-L-E. It's good. I read it a long time ago and really benefited from it. And I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. I wake up in the morning with tacos on my mind. I eat a couple tacos and I hit the grind. Before I leave the house, I make sure I lock it. In case I get hungry, I got tacos in my pocket. When I'm with my friends, I don't care what they say.